Welcome to For the Love of Conversation, the podcast that grew out of 3 Minute Storyteller, where we believe conversations connect us and social change begins with the stories we tell. At 3 Minute Storyteller, we share digital stories, video snippets of intimate, messy, expansive conversations with a wildly eclectic bunch of artists, scientists, leaders of all stripes, all who are legendary change agents. Some you may know, and hopefully many you don't. This podcast is the opportunity to bring you into the full conversation. I'm Shannon Mannon, along with my husband Mike and our VW bus Scarlett, who we've outfitted into an awesome mobile storytelling unit. We invite you into the full conversation with us. We're so glad you're along for the ride. It truly was a joy to be in conversation with KJ Dell'Antonia. KJ is the beloved writer and editor behind the New York Times Motherlode blog and has a new book out called How to Be a Happier Parent, Raising a Family, Having a Life, and Loving Almost Every Minute. We spoke about what can be the counterintuitive aspect of parenting, that within this hugely important role, and for most of us who aren't finding a cure for cancer, raising our children will most likely be the most important contribution we ever make to society. Yet to do it well and to do it with the kind of joy and ease that we want to bring into our homes and that we deserve for ourselves and our families, it often requires us to do less, not more. So listen as KJ and I dig into topics ranging from letting go to questioning the sanity of having a whole newspaper section dedicated to sports when family life, health, parenting, and just overall well-being, the building blocks of a good life, don't get nearly that kind of real estate. And what it took for her to break into writing and how she's now helping new writers to do the same. I hope you enjoy this conversation with KJ as much as I did. You've been such a trusted friend in your writing to so many of us through the New York Times, through the blog, and through...
Welcome to For the Love of Conversation, the podcast that grew out of 3 Minute Storyteller, where we believe conversations connect us and social change begins with the stories we tell. At 3 Minute Storyteller, we share digital stories, video snippets of intimate, messy, expansive conversations with a wildly eclectic bunch of artists, scientists, leaders of all stripes, all who are legendary change agents, some you may know and hopefully many you don't. This podcast is the opportunity to bring you into the full conversation. I'm Shannon Mannon. Along with my husband Mike and our VW bus Scarlett, who we've outfitted into an awesome mobile storytelling unit.
I was actually an only child.
We invite you into the full conversation.
Dad was the first one in his family to go to college.
We're so glad you're along for the ride.
Also, my mother went to college when I was 3, I think. She started and then she got out. She became a teacher. And so I grew up with, you know, parents who were striving and very upwardly mobile. And we moved a lot. My dad took a lot of different jobs. My mom was a teacher. And we were pretty tight. My parents were great. They thought I could do anything, but they didn't pay. I never felt the fact that I was an only child was not, I was not the center of their attention. It didn't feel like that at all. The only problem was that if somebody ate all the Cheetos, it was invariably me. I really resented not having anyone else to blame that stuff on. And my mom was really great around food. It's actually something I've tried really hard to emulate. She never, I was a pretty picky eater. She didn't make a big thing of it. I have zero food issues. Of women of my generation, I feel like that's like, I'm like one of like 5% or something. She didn't, if I ate it, I ate it. If I didn't eat it, I didn't eat it. I remember like one time when I was very small, sort of sitting at the table on one of those like you must eat one bite vigils, and I didn't eat one bite, and I guess she didn't enjoy it. And then they were just like, yeah, whatever. Here, have a grilled cheese. And it was never, and I eat everything now. Like I totally got through it. But the fact that I don't struggle with, you know, weight or what I eat or sugar or wanting, we had all the food. We had lots of junk food around. If you ate it, you ate it. If you didn't eat it, you didn't eat it. We had Coke all the time, which I don't have in my house, but it's just different. And it was just sort of all, I look back on not feeling any pressure around that as like a real gift. And it's hard to emulate because things are a little different now. And, you know, we want to teach lessons around food and healthy eating and sustainable living and all that stuff. And then we want to teach those without creating body issues. And I just look back on my mom and the fact that she just didn't do anything about it. And I feel so grateful.
I love that story. And I'm not surprised because such a through line in your book is around less doing, you know,
yeah.
Like so much is like less action. And you know, it's so funny to write a whole book about like, really just relax, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, there was so much more to it. I'm not trying to be reductive. But it really like.
Well, the funny thing is that that's not how it started out. So the first book proposal was about having more fun as a parent. So I made all this list of like the fun things that we could do. And I was going to spend a year because I love Gretchen Rubin's The Happiness Project. And I thought a year, that'd be a great structure. I left some structure. We'll do a fun thing every month and roller coasters and pulling taffy. And I had this list and I started this proposal and I would just look at it. And I realized I don't want to do fun things. I don't want to do anything more than I'm already doing. It just made me want to cry. So yeah, no fun things, no more things at all. I just want to enjoy what we're already doing more. And it turns out that a huge root to that is to do fewer things so that you can enjoy the things that you're doing more. But that's hard because there are so many opportunities. I mean, there are opportunities for us as adults. There are opportunities for our kids. It feels very scary, like if our kids don't take advantage of all the opportunities, then, you know, maybe they won't get the same advantages as the ones kids who did. You really have to have a lot of faith in the value of downtime and playtime and family time to preserve it in our culture, because we're not putting a lot of value on it right now. And I love being a defender of that, both sort of at home and with my kids and my family, and just helping other people to realize if your kid doesn't start soccer at 4, that doesn't mean they can't play soccer. Or alternatively, if your kid doesn't play soccer, that's okay. You know, like it's all good. Like if your kid spends all their time playing soccer, you know, then they're never going to discover that what they're really fascinated by is amphibians. We need that time to explore our own, or our kids need that time to sort of explore their own person and their own interests and what they do when they are not scheduled. And we have a hard time with that because we want to control everything.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like, you know, in kind of thinking about it and really pondering that, like, why, you know, I get into taskmaster mode very much as a mom, to-do lists and accomplish things. And, you know, I think it's reflective of our culture. Like you said, we don't do slow and reflective and simple and less in a capitalistic, you know, very fast-paced society. And it's, you know, the conundrum of, like, you know, parenthood is all work and no joy. And reducing it like that is horrible. But I wonder if part of it is that, you know, intuitively, parenting is so important to us. And it feels like if we are not doing instead of being, we're not honoring the, do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Does that get at?
My friend and colleague Lisa Damore said to me, I don't think she's written this anywhere, that it's in my book, I quoted her. She said she wishes someone would do a study that showed that just spending time with your kids doing absolutely nothing useful would actually like paid off in some grant. Because, she, you know, we were both talking about how we feel like if we're not like, doing something, like we know ballet lessons lead to something, you know, but we don't know that like sitting around watching YouTube videos leads to something. And we feel like everything needs to lead to something, like we're really scared. And the truth is, if you let go of your 11-year-old boy's homework and you say to him, this, you know, it's time for you to take this, then for like a month or 6 weeks or some period that is way, way longer than you can easily stand, he's gonna screw it up. Like, it's gonna go badly. You're gonna get calls from the all of a sudden your kid's not doing the homework and things. And to let that sort of go all the way down to the level of almost drowning without swimming down after it and pulling it up is really, really, I don't want to pretend that it's not hard. And I'm not able to do it in like every area, but, you know, we can't control all the outcomes. So letting go and practicing letting the outcomes be what they are and letting our kids find their own outcomes. It's really good for all of us.
And I think I'm reminded of when you said that, of Tiffany Dufu's Drop the Ball, when she said, I don't know if you've read that, but
yes.
She talks about, you have to like go all in.
Yeah.
Like if your partner knows that you're going to bail them out, it ain't happening. And your kids too, they sense, oh, mom will catch me. You almost have to prove it to yourself.
Yeah.
And
yeah. No. And I mean, some of the advantage of having four kids is that you can't carry all the balls. Like my kids know if you are counting on me to pack your hockey gear and bring it to you, you're not going to get your hockey gear. You're going to get some of yours and some of your brothers and maybe your dad's and maybe mine. I mean, God knows what I will put. And it's not, I've played, I know what goes in the bag, but it's really confusing and I'm in a hurry. And also I don't care. I mean, I care some, but I don't care like you do. So yeah, they're not, if you ask me, your odds are not great. Similarly, if you tell me you're out of underwear, it might be a couple of weeks before I get to you. But if you go on, you know, you can go back. One of my kids, I'll find her on the computer and she doesn't have a solid grasp of sort of how computers online stuff. So she'll search like dress for school picture. And, you know, she'll be like, can I get this one? And I'll be like, well, honey, that's for an American Girl doll. So no, but that'll make me get on for, so they're trying to help themselves.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's independence.
Yeah. Yeah. Like this is, you said I was a size, you said, okay, I'm in fourth grade and this is a size four. Will that work? No. That's not how sizing works. So.
But yeah. Go you. Gold star.
Yes. Thank you for trying.
Exactly.
You have now got my attention. I will help you buy this dress.
We'll go to the store now.
Yeah.
And that, it brings me to joy. So joy, such a thing for me right now. And I'm like every day setting my intention. I will do this life with joy. And again, it's such a theme in your book. But it's so hard for me to get my head to say it's not something to do. It's
right.
A state
that
of
was
being.
Exactly how I wanted to respond to you, which is
right.
Like, it's not I will do this day with joy. It's I will find the joy in this day. And that really means, I mean, you know, I get a lot of joy out of going to Walmart with a list that says toothpaste, paper towels, bleach, and leaving Walmart with nothing but toothpaste, paper towels, and bleach, because I have stuck it to the man, right? Like that is a pleasure for me. Ha ha, you didn't get me with your display of sunscreen. We might need sunscreen. I don't care. I'll share that on social media. I'll tell all my friends. I'll do a blog post about it. You know, treasuring the joy in the dumb stuff. Because really, 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 most of us have it good. Most of us, if you're listening to this, you probably have a roof and enough food. And, you know, you're arguing with me, but you're like, but things could happen. But the bad thing, and, you know, that's a trick that our brains play on us. Our brains want us to be panicking over the bad things that could happen all the time. And the result is that we live our lives as though the bad thing was happening all the time. And then when the bad thing happens, and it does, it will, all you want back is that moment at Walmart when all you bought were the three things. You're like, can we go back in time to when, you know, nobody had called me with this disastrous phone call and my kids were, the worst problem I had was with my kids having a tantrum in the back of my really pretty nice and gasoline-filled car? Yeah, but our brains mess with us. They push us into like living in that panicked mode all the time. And it's a struggle. So you really have to teach yourself, train yourself to look at all the great things that we have right now and not worry about the fact that we might not have them in 10 minutes.
And so as your journey progressed in writing the book, you wrote about how your own happiness progression really did fundamentally change.
Yeah, I'm way happier. And I'm not, people have asked me, well, you're probably a naturally happy person. I'm like, no.
You look so sunny.
Yeah, you guys, as my parents would tell you, like, I was the whiniest child. Oh my God. It was horrible. I complained all the time. Yeah, no,
it's all the Cheez-Its or Cheetos, right? Probably, that's right. You know?
No, I once had someone at a job that I was at that I disliked intensely, and that person also disliked the job intensely. We used to really gripe all the time. We'd have these gripe sessions. And that person finally looked at me and said, you know, I've been giving this some thought and I want to keep this job, and I can't keep it if we keep doing this. So I'm actually going to it's not, we're still friends, but I don't want to have, and I was like, whoa. And of course, instantly I totally did not change and went right into parenthood as exactly that same person. And finally, I guess the light dawned, and I just realized I didn't want to be that person anymore either, but it took a while.
Yeah, that's powerful, because that's like a punch in the gut.
I know, and I totally didn't change.
Yeah. But so how did you
know what, though? I didn't want to keep that job. I actually didn't. Yeah. It was kind of me going, okay, I actually don't want to keep this job. So even though I only lasted 6 months in that job.
But so how did, what was it? Was it the mindset? Was it a mind training? What do you attribute your...
I think I just got tired of it. I mean, I've tried to find a good story that is, because it'd be great. I could tell it when I'm speaking. And I've tried, but there's not, I don't know that it's a moment. Mm-hmm. I had a friend who really blew up their family life, and it was someone I had complained with a lot. And so to some extent, being I don't want my family to feel like I am as unhappy as she is. So there was a little bit of that in there, but I really think I just got tired of the churning. And, you know, the world started to talk a little bit more about happiness and you know, meditation and finding. It became sort of more of a thing that people were doing and talking about, and I got interested. So, but mostly, yeah, I think I just got sick of being miserable.
Yeah. It's simple.
Yeah.
Really.
And the amount of time I used to spend worrying about all the bad things that could happen, It astonishes me now. I was looking at a list that I made, and I must have made this 3 years ago, and it was things I do to be happier and things I do that still make me less happier. And one of the things I had written down was I don't spend time churning on all the fears that could come true.
And you didn't start a meditation practice or this mindfulness practice?
I do.
Because it feels like that's... how do you train your mind without that? I'm just wondering.
Yeah. No, I do try. Yeah. I mean, I do meditate a little bit. I got a 10-minute a day practice or something, but I only started that a year ago, if that. It's more, I guess, the person that really I talked to that helped me was Rick Hansen and his Hardwiring Happiness. And his explanation of why our brain wants to sort of circle around those bad things that could possibly happen, and his discussion of how you can step out of that, I don't know, I just found it really empowering.
When the student is ready, the teacher will come.
I guess that was it.
Yeah. I want to talk about your, kind of the context of, you know, when you edited the Motherlode blog and that turned into the Well Family blog at the New York Times. Your a lot of your writing and work was around, as a journalist, policy and systemic issues, and pivoting to this book, which is much more personal and individual, very empowering on that smaller individual level. And so I think about your career as a kind of as a whole, and I'm just wondering how does that work in you? How's that, you know, has it been something that you hold together? Is there a creative tension there?
Well, I mean, I definitely thought about writing the more societal, cultural book. Mm-hmm. You know, the more this is what we do wrong for parents, this is how we could make it better. I felt two things about that. And first, that I felt it'd been done, and it's been done very well. I didn't feel like I could top, Anne Marie or Bridget Salty or any of the people that have sort of already gone in there. But even more relevantly, I felt like I had a problem, which was that I'm in the middle of this thing that I wanted to do so badly, and it's not going great. It's not feeling good. And realistically, you could bestow us right this minute with family leave and affordable daycare and a change in summer and stuff like that, and that would not fix things for me. I don't need baby family leave. That ship has sailed. So, and also it would take time. It would take a couple years to make it happen. And I, by then, my, So I just wanted to figure out, like, what could we do, you know, me and my sort of generation, people who have kids right now from 4 to 16 who are in this, who have this, we've got the cards we've been dealt. What can we do to make it better right now? So that's what I was going for. And I think it's huge. I have definitely struggled with this as like a light subject, a women's subject. What is it they say? The F's, food, fashion, furniture, and family. Those are what women write about. That infuriates me, right? Because, you know, like how many pages of our media do we devote to sports? I love sports, great. I love hockey. I mean, I don't actually love all sports, but I love hockey. But really, that's more important than whether or not we have family leave. That's more important than your relationship with your family. That's more important than, like, you know, what's going on with your parents and your kids and your, that, I just want to, like, shred things when I, you know, but sports journalists are regarded as more real journalists than I am in some, and sometimes that would happen at the Times and it would be very frustrating.
That's such a good point. I'm so glad you brought that up.
It's getting better, I will say.
Do you see a difference?
It is getting better, but it's still a struggle. And some of it is because it is personal. You know, we can tell these personal stories, and there's a tendency to say, well, to rely on anecdotal evidence, not data. And so then people are like, well, that's not really real because you're just talking about the people that you've talked to. But I do think it's getting better.
I think it speaks to this idea that we don't value, to our earlier conversation about being versus doing, you know, if in a culture where we don't like kind of economically and culturally value care, you know, as an economic
engine. No, we really don't.
You know,
yeah.
Like how can...
There was this great piece, Nancy Fulbray. I remembered her name. She wrote it in the Times, and it was all about how if it fell to one group of society to create the machinery that would do the work that would carry on society into the future. Like, let's just propose a world in which you have to, you know, you have to build these robots that are going to be the one thing that will take care of us all as we get older. We would value that so much if we looked at that way, but we don't value raising the children that are gonna fill those roles. You know, to us, that's like, you're just doing that for yourself, honey. You just raise your little kid and we'll pat you on the head and good luck with that. But come on. I mean, that kid's gonna be, you know, that's gonna be your doctor. That's gonna be your healthcare attendant. That's gonna be the person who's looking after your streets, who's building your bridges. Seriously? You know, we're not going to help out with that? No, apparently we're not.
Well, and your elder care too, yeah. You know, guess what? You're going to get older, person, yeah. Who's all powerful right now, and who's going to be, you know, putting food in your mouth? A robot, you know? And,
yes.
You know?
Yeah, and we just sort of think it'll just happen.
And so, but you're seeing shifts in that on a larger level? Like
I think it's getting taken a little bit more seriously. And well, great, some of that is because men are paying more attention to it. But let's just say that's because we're all paying more attention to it. It's becoming more of a focus.
One of your mantras, which we haven't talked about yet in the book is, this may not be exactly it, so correct me. How I remember it is when I was writing this question is what we want now isn't what we want later.
Yeah.
And it's so much about, you know, that building resiliency. I want you to kind of explain that in your own words, because that one was one that worked for me really well. And
found myself. Yeah, I come back to that a lot. I mean, what you want now is not always what you will want later. I mean, let's say that your 3-year-old's balloon has just floated off into the sky. You want nothing more at that moment than just for somebody to hand you another balloon to hand to that kid so that kid will stop. But, you know, honestly, we don't want to raise a kid who's never so much as lost a balloon. That would be the worst college roommate ever. So there are so many areas in which this applies. It is totally easier to clean up the plates after dinner yourself than it is to make your kids do it. It will totally make your immediate moment more pleasant. But it's probably not what it's not what you want your kids to learn about contributing to the family. Or if it is, then that's, you know, some people make that call. But homework. You know, what you want now is for your kid to go trotting back to school and get rewarded for the gold star for having all their addition problems right. But what you want later is a kid who can, you know, do their own homework on their own without you prompting them. Screen time. What you want now is for your kid to just put that phone down. But what you want later is for a kid who understands why they need to put the phone down, why it's important to do other things. And so that may be a conversation rather than a rule. It depends on how old your kid is. There are just a ton of areas where it's like, I could do something to make my life so much easier now, but it's not. That's not the long run thing. And that's actually this weird happiness dichotomy. So I finally figured out why these things play in. The way that academics measure parental happiness, they look at something called efficacy, which means, do you feel like you're good at this thing? And people who feel like they're pretty good at parenting, people who feel, I mean, not great, but people who feel solid in their choices, tend to feel happier. So what I think is that even though, repeating pick up the towel, pick up the towel, pick up the towel 46 times is not making you immediately happier, it makes you feel better, you're doing the right thing. Like, you know it's better if your kid picks up the towel, or you know it's better if your kid learns to do their own homework. And that gives you a greater, sort of larger sense of happiness. So that took me a while to figure out, how do those relate? Because really, I would totally feel happier if I could just put the dish in the dishwasher and have done with it.
Yeah, it's the candy, right? It's like, it's just, yeah.
Yeah, I would feel happier if I just fed them candy and they all smiled.
I think we all would be very happy. And it's, you know, I think the question of resilience, your story really mirrors, you know, as coming from a law career, leaving New York after 9/11 and creating a new life for yourself. Well, I don't know if you left.
It wasn't related. It was about then that we left, but it wasn't related.
It wasn't related to that.
No, so we were going to stick it out. We were fine.
Yeah.
We lasted a year. We had a kid. He was born right before. So, yeah.
And then, but then you reinvented yourself.
He did.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that's, you know, that's the hard stuff. Like, right, these are the building. It was a struggle, right? I'm assuming. I'm guessing that
no,
was a tough...
No, it all came really easily as flow. And people knocked on my door. They said, hi, would you like to write for the New York Times? Yeah, no.
New York Times here. Yeah. We're KJ's
wait,
in there.
Do I hear it now? It's the New Yorker.
You're going to have to wait till next week.
Yes. That's actually David Sedaris' advice for writers. It's the worst possible advice ever. He gave it to us on our podcast. And I actually stopped and was like... That is the worst advice
wait, so
I've ever heard.
Wait for
yes.
someone to knock.
He said, you shouldn't ask for things. You should wait for people to come to you. Because asking is rude. I was like, that doesn't work for anyone else, David. And he said, no, I wanted to write for the New Yorker. And, you know, anyway.
That was hilarious.
Like, wow. Okay. So no. Yeah. We left. So we left New York with an agreement, my husband and me and our almost 2-year-old. And that agreement was, I don't want to leave New York. Thank you very much. But we're going to, because you have this great job. And we're going to give this a shot. But we're going to have, you know, babysitting, and I'm going to build this writing career. And then I went and I looked at how other people, like I dissected. I went and found, like, here is someone whose career I would like to emulate. What did they do? Where did they start? And then I started like, and this was when you like mailed queries to magazines in the mail with stamps. And I started with front of the book, and I would write these 300 word, I wrote for a magazine called ePregnancy, which weirdly enough was not online at all. I, to this day, have no idea why it was called ePregnancy, but they were great to me. I wrote a ton of front of book stuff, and then I finally moved on to like writing something bigger for them. And then I just stopped writing for them and tried to move on. Bigger publication. I was very methodical. And I applied. And I tried to, you know, treat myself as a young white man would, which is to just apply for it, even if you are not already fully qualified. I just kept chugging. And you know, it did work, but it was neither fast nor easy.
And I love that you were one of the first like telecommuters, right? For the Times. Like,
probably. I don't really know. But so the
first. But that was a line you drew in the sand at a very.
Oh, yeah. I wasn't going anywhere.
Yeah.
So that was my first. I mean, I was writing for Slate before that, but they would not have considered me an employee. And I wasn't technically an employee at the time. I was a freelance contractor, but it was a full-time position. The first job I applied for at the Times, I actually didn't get for exactly that reason. It was this children's book reviewer. And I went in and I had said in my email, you know, I would do this from where I live. But I guess that the guy that interviewed me was so, like, it never occurred to him that anyone would want to do that. So he must have just not even read that sentence. So we have this fantastic interview. And then he says, well, would you be willing to move to New York? And I say, no. And he says, but New York is the center of the literary universe. And I wait for the laugh, and there isn't one. And that was pretty much the end of the interview. And it was very, very depressing, because I'd have been great at that. But I mean, in retrospect, they wanted you sort of there with the boxes of books and everything. It could have been done. It could have been done that way. And the person that did get that job was Pam Paul. And she's the head of the book review now. And she's fantastic. And she's so good at it. So, you know, it all worked out for the best. But yeah, he was not open. But then when I went in and talked to the people about the Motherlode blog, Megan Lieberman and Rick Burke, they're neither of them's at the Times anymore, but they were willing to take a chance. The previous person had been in the office, Lisa Belkin. But they were game. They were up for it. And I think it worked out well for all of us.
And speaking of that, like, so when, you know, I think when you were in the early days of it feels like you were in the early days of the internet.
I was.
So you guys kind of helped cultivate, in my sense, as a reader, the first online parenting community that we sort of know now as such a thing.
I would say, I mean, when I came to the Times, Lisa had already had established that, but it became, I think, even more of a community as I was there. It was really, we had more other writers. We had this really vigorous comment section, which I moderated very carefully and thoughtfully. That was a huge part of my job. And yeah, it was a real community. It was great. What they have now is different. Yeah. So, and I think that's true. Like, there was sort of this, you know, the heyday of online community. Yeah. And now it's, you know, it's not quite, people tend to be creating them with the idea of monetizing them. And so the fact that having them grow organic, like Reddit is still a thriving series of massive, lots and lots of communities, some of which are not appealing and some of which are, but it still works. But I don't know that you could start it now.
Yeah.
But people are, you know, they really want to try.
I want to talk a little bit about your podcast with Jess, your Am Writing podcast, which I love. And it's, and I think so much, you guys, it's witty, it's resourceful, it's so personal. But I guess for the sake of this question, storytelling is really something you guys, I've learned a lot about listening to you when you talk. What is it about compelling stories as a writer that you would say is like essential in the work that you do?
Well, you know, there's brain science out there that says that stories are feeding us. They're feeding that fear of threat. They're feeding our need to know what we would do if something happened. So when you couch anything in a story, we're more likely to remember it. We're more likely to be interested. So storytelling in both fiction and nonfiction is really, it's really important. And for Jess and I with the podcast, to some extent, we're just sitting there and telling each other about what we're doing because we are two people that have grown up in this industry together. And I mean, people don't realize, but and our third person, Serena Bowen, who appears fairly frequently, she's a romance writer. I mean, the three of us were sitting around in an Indian restaurant when I found out the Motherlode job had opened up. Like, that's how we were sitting around when Jess was trying to write a memoir about moving to New England, and I was, you know, writing little tiny, I was writing reviews for Common Sense Media, and Serena was the most successful of all of us. She had written a cookbook and was working on a novel. We were just getting there. And so what we really want to do is like bring people into that feeling of this is how you build this and it can be done. Like, we did it, you know, successfully. We're all, and we did it together. Like, we didn't have to, we've totally helped each other. I mean, both Serena and Jess wrote for me at the Times, but then, you know, Jess shifted over to the Atlantic where I've never written. And I mean, you know, as we did things, we sort of helped each other to you know, like, come on, I can help you do this. We can do this too. And it wasn't competitive. It just, it worked. And we really want to bring people on board with that idea that you can do this, and you can do it by sort of working with other people.
Well, and I think it's women, you know?
Yeah,
it
that's
really
true.
It runs counter to the messages that we get, that women are so competitive and they fight each other. It's like, it's actually this incredibly collaborative dynamic.
Well, the great thing about books is that hardly ever anyone just buys one. So you can be as generous as you want to within the game of writing books. You can share everyone else's books, because honestly, if you've, you know, nobody, even if you want a book about parenting, about family, you probably aren't just going to buy one book about that. You're going to be interested in others. If you like books about strategizing and deep thinking, you're going to buy a bunch of those. So those authors can come together and share each other without even feeling like they're giving somebody else a piece of their pie. So it's very nice that we have that going for us. I mean, nobody's going to like go, well, I could either buy Jess's book or Serena's book or KJ's book. No, that's not how people think.
Just to sort of close this up, I want to think about your kids. Have they said anything to you? Have they noticed? Have they said something about, Mom, you seem different?
Nobody has said, you seem happier. I did have this fantastic moment when one of my kids, I think we have those conversation cards on the dinner table, which we never, ever, ever use. They just sit there. But at some point, one of them pulled it out. And the question must have had something to do with patience. I don't remember what the question was, but I was like, oh no, I'm totally not a patient person. And one of my kids was like, yes, you are. You're very patient. You're always like waiting for us to do things. And look how slowly you make the Rice Krispie treats. Because I was telling them, you have to wait for all the things to. And I just thought that was lovely, because I've never felt like a patient person. So I think to some extent, because they were fairly young when I started this, especially my younger kids just kind of see me as more of a chill person, I think if you asked them, they would remember that there have been, and I still lose my temper. I mean, it's not like I'm perfect. So, but I think overall they probably have spent more time on the one that maybe hasn't would be my oldest, and he is naturally a happy person himself. So he probably would, you know, he would just be like, yes, it's always been lovely, because that is how he feels about life.
I love it. It's good.
It is great. It's wonderful. He's the only, my other kids are not like that, but it's wonderful that we have him to be that way.
Yeah, exactly. Perfect. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to my conversation with KJ Dell'Antonia. If you want more from KJ, follow her on Twitter at KJ Dell'Antonia. To get the How to Be a Happier Parent book and for tons of great tips and resources, check out her website at followkj.com. And for all you writers out there, also be sure to check out the hashtag AmWritingPodcast that KJ does with her good friend and fellow writer, the brilliant Jess Leahy. It's available on iTunes, and you should subscribe. Links to everything can be found at our website, 3ms.co. That's the number 3, the letters ms.co. And while you're there, subscribe to our mailing list so you never miss a story from us.